Hello, everyone, and welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and thanks for joining me here for episode number 332, which is the very first episode of the new year, 2022. So I'm excited to be starting over again, in a sense, in a new year, and I'm grateful that you're here with me to get this year off to a great start. In just a moment, I'll be sharing an interview with Jeremy Powell all about technology that is on the horizon for use in end-of-life care, hospice and palliative care. And I know just the word technology might scare some of you away. It scared me a little bit at first, but this is a fascinating interview. It really shows us where we're headed in the future, but for me, it also gave me a lot of hope. So please take a listen. Don't give up. Don't be deterred by the word technology. Take a listen, and you'll probably learn something new, as I did. Before we start with the interview, I just want to mention the online reading group, A Year of Reading Dangerously, is getting started for 2022. There's a brand new reading list for this year, and you can sign up for it. I'll leave the link in the show notes for this episode at eolupodcast.com. And just look for episode number 332. There will be a link there in the show notes, and you can sign up if you're interested in reading a book a month this year around dying, death, grief, and the afterlife. Then I'd also like to thank my latest supporters on Patreon, Mary Ganapol and Catherine Pettis. I hope I've pronounced your names correctly. Mary and Catherine, so grateful to you for joining our team and offering to support the podcast with a small donation each month. We now have just 10 donors to go to reach the goal I set in order to start offering transcripts for every episode. A lot of people have asked me for that, for those who have difficulty hearing, who might prefer to read along while they're listening to make sure they get all the words correct. And some of us would rather read than listen. So we're well on our way to that goal. And hopefully, I'll be able to start offering it fairly soon, but it would be great to get 10 more people signing up on my page at patreon.com/EOLU. If you'd like to join our team for as little as $2 a month, you can become a supporter and you'll receive some bonuses there, like the end-of-life news update that I curate for you every month, for at least for all my patrons. And put it out there for you so you can learn what's happening in the end of life world. And this month, I received a message from Bruce Wadd, who's one of my Patreon supporters, who said, "I listen to you as I walk in the morning and deeply value the wisdom and encouragement. Thanks, Bruce, for reaching out. I value your encouragement." So I'll mention it again to all of you. I love hearing from you, so feel free, send me an email or a message through Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or also on the Patreon page. And I'd love hearing from you. I like seeing your pictures of where and how you're listening to the podcast and feeling connected to you. So thanks to all of you who have reached out to me. So now, without further ado, we'll get on to my conversation with Jeremy Powell. Remember to stay tuned after this interview, and I'll be back with a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go. Today, I'm very happy to welcome my guest, Jeremy Powell. Jeremy is the founder and chief executive officer of Acclivity Health Solutions, a company that continually strives to innovate and deliver the technologies providers need to ensure patients with advanced illness receive the right care at the right time in the right setting, while honoring the patient's dignity, goals, and values. Jeremy's career started at the bedside in physical therapy, where he quickly recognized the need to affect exponential change in advanced illness management and founded Acclivity Health Solutions. Jeremy is a frequent speaker for national healthcare conferences, and you can learn more at the website acclivityhealth.com. So, Jeremy, thanks so much for joining me today.
Dr. Wyatt, thank you for having me.
Well, I'm so excited to talk to you. A little bit apprehensive because we're going to go into some technology areas that I don't have very much knowledge about, but I'm happy that you've reassured me. We're going to walk through it step by step. So hopefully I'll be able to wrap my head around all of it.
Sure. Well, a million years ago, and not in my bio, I was a school teacher, and parts of that teaching was always sort of recognizing that there are questions that some people just are afraid to ask. So hopefully in this conversation, we do truly have you feeling very brave and asking any question that comes to mind.
All right. Yes. And I'll admit that I don't know very much about certain areas, machine learning and artificial intelligence. Those are pretty new to me, but we'll get there a little later on in the conversation. I thought we should start by talking about where we are right now. This interview is airing at the end of 2021, the beginning of a new year. And I wanted to talk about some of the challenges that we're facing in the hospice sector today, some of the things that are wrong with our system that all of us really recognize, but maybe things that have inspired you to create Acclivity Health Solutions. So would you just review some of those with me?
Sure. So some of the biggest challenges I think we face have to do, it goes without saying that COVID changed a lot of how care is delivered, how patients get access to certain clinical teams, how their families might be impacted by whether or not they can get into facilities based upon how much COVID or spikes are happening related to COVID protocols. Putting that aside for a second, prior to the pandemic, there was always this concern about understanding the health of the referral stream. You heard in my bio, physical therapy was part of my background. We lived by referral in that market as well. And any organization which requires another entity to sort of have command and control of your pipeline or of your future patient, level of census, length of stay, those are still the bigger issues and challenges facing hospice. And where I see those things really starting to impact them long term are there are some perverse incentives that make other parts of care tend to hold on to persons well into the hospice benefit. Those perverse incentives might be hospitalization events where there are lots of billable items that can occur for a health system that's a hospital anchored health system. So they'll tend to hold on to persons way longer than potentially appropriate for the benefit of hospice to be applied well. This current administration under President Biden thinks about health equity as a significant cornerstone of their approach and platform. If you think about hospice as an example, it's 80% Caucasian. Like, that's another big challenge that will be addressed. But these things are I think, tip of the spear, and the most heavy weighing on every hospice today is how do I increase my length of stay? How do I get these patients sooner in their journey? How do I get more of them? Because on average, we're seeing sometimes between like 30% and 50% of persons who are hospice eligible get any service. Like, that's a really bad outcome where we're having deaths in inappropriate places. So those are the biggest challenges really that are keeping folks up tonight, every night.
And these things were all true for me during my days as a hospice medical director as well. I can't even count the number of times we had a hospice patient admitted in the last 3 or 4 days of life. And we would have to rush in, try to give all the care we could in the last few days, knowing we could have been involved with this patient and their family months earlier and could have been providing services to them the entire time. The patient could have had the comfort of being in their own home all of that time, getting symptom management and comfort care, and the family receiving the support they needed. And it was just tragic every time that happened. But we had such a barrier to overcome trying to educate physicians and motivate them to send us patients earlier. So for me, I saw that as one of the barriers, just being trying to get my colleagues on board with the idea that hospice care and also palliative care are a good thing for patients. So do you have ideas for overcoming that obstacle?
I do. And we're delivering on these ideas too. So the ideas around sort of removing that obstacle of having folks understand and make the referrals in a timely fashion. I often talk about if you were to discover in primary care that a person had a mass that could have been potentially cancerous, you can order a pathology lab, right? You can do a punch biopsy, and then you get back black and white answers, benign or malignant, right? And then you can make decisions from that. We don't have a pathology result for last 6 months of life, right? Like there's not any punch biopsy that you could be taking any part of a human that will tell you, oh, this is senescence. It's the end of life. They're not going to recover from invasive procedures. You need to consider a different approach. Like that doesn't exist in, Quest and LabCorp aren't building those kinds of labs, right? Laboratory sort of, abilities. We are as an organization, and we're joined by a number of other academics. Like this isn't just Acclivity strength. Like Sutter is doing this. University of Minnesota is doing this. Google took Stanford's data and is doing this. So what this is the ability to sort of look at why those, when you were a clinician in hospice, why those colleagues of yours didn't feel comfortable sort of using hospice as a specialty like they are oncology is largely due to an inexperience in sort of predicting which cases are appropriate for it. The would you be surprised question is not very scientific. It's an okay measure, but what's a better measure is something that can literally predict a time series event like death and be really accurate at that prediction. And one of the technologies that does that, that we employ, that Stanford employs, that University of Minnesota employs and the like is machine learning. And just for a simple definition, so everybody can sort of, we can have a real conversation and everybody can understand a basic example. Machine learning really is just a computer capability that looks at the data itself and learns from what it sees. And a real world example of that in all of our lives is any traffic app that you use on your phone to navigate from one place to another will start suggesting routes that are faster. And all it's doing is looking at the number of persons whose phone are on that system, like Google Maps or Apple Maps or Waze or any of your favorite, and recognizing that the pace at which those phones are moving through space is slower on that route versus that route. Therefore, they can predict that you would make it to your destination faster going on the faster route. That's literally machine learning. And if you think about what we are doing relative to prognostication, it's literally looking at all the data we have on about 4.5 million patients and saying this particular person looks just like these cases that died within 3 months or 6 months or 12 months. And when you have that level of sophistication, now those colleagues of yours that were afraid to or were not experienced enough to or didn't have a good sort of rapport with the patients or didn't feel comfortable, whatever it was, now they have a specialty tool that can literally say, okay, these are the cases I have to have the conversation for. And if I'm unafraid or if I'm not capable or I'm afraid to do it, I at least can get someone on my staff that can. And I think that's a big difference between when you were trying to get your colleagues to sort of recognize it and what we have today as tech.
And wow, you're so right about that, because it's obviously a major issue, that idea of trying to prognosticate. And not only do doctors themselves lack the information that would help them make a prognosis, they might have other internal reasons why it's difficult to do that. Maybe that feels like playing God if they try to offer a prognosis. Maybe they themselves don't really want to face end of life issues and talk about death and dying, and it makes them avoid that. But if you can put something data-based in their hands, I'm sure that would increase their comfort level with looking at prognosis and then making the right referral.
Yeah, I think you're right on the money. We think about it as being unwilling to take off their Superman cape. That's a hard thing to do. Especially when you don't feel comfortable in the conversation or even the journey. So one of the things that we do to help them be comfortable is propensity scoring. So it's one thing for this magic, Google app to tell you it's faster to go this other way to your house. It's another thing for us to tell you that we can practice a part of medicine more efficiently than you can. That feels wrong to a lot of clinicians because they practiced over time in their clinical training but also their experience with more patients give them a compass. So if we show them some tool that hasn't informed their compass, it feels disconnected. Propensity scoring, which is some of the things we do, says, well, I can find you digital twins in our 4.5 million patients today and growing every day. And I can say, of the persons that are digital twins for this patient, here are their outcomes. Here are the medications that they will have to onboard. Here are the other levels of care that will be applied: emergency department care, hospital care, skilled nursing facility care, critical care inside of the ICU. Like, we can literally show what happens to cases just like them and show when they passed, so that just like you learn in your own practice, you can see through this extension of our 4 million patients what other organizations literally, or other patients literally, have experienced. So that helps you feel more confident and comfortable.
Yeah, and I can imagine where doctors are a little bit nervous about making a pronouncement to a patient of, you have 6 months to live, you need to be on hospice right now, because it sounds like you're offering the patient no hope. You're predicting doom and gloom. If you have a tool that's telling you this is a likely scenario for the patient you're caring for, first of all, you have data to back you up, but it removes a little bit of the personal responsibility, I guess, for making that decision, because it isn't that you're in your own head trying to draw that conclusion. There is data that informs you that that's the right conclusion to draw. And I wanted to ask you about machine learning, just a quick question about that. Is it the case that the more data you put in with machine learning, the better the data you get out becomes, so that over time, the quality of the data keeps improving? Is that how it works?
Yeah, it definitely requires big data sets, meaning multiple patients from multiple different geographies, from multiple different cultures, from multiple different disease states. And it also learns, honestly, from what becomes something called importance of feature. So if we were trying to predict whether you matched one of our cases, the importance of features in our system that really drive good matching include: what's your palliative performance scale prediction, your functional status prediction? What are the frailty markers that we see in the data? So things like, you're a fall risk, or you've had significant neurological deficits that are making you often confused and not lucid. Like, those kinds of things sort of surface, bubble up to the top and surface as the very most important things to look at as it relates to, like, the features within that data set. So you need a lot of patients, and then you need to have the ability to sort of distill the features about those patients that really are the most important for predicting death. And the model itself will keep getting better. And what I mean by that is, it would say every time we take a new patient or a new cohort of patients in, it would say, okay, there are new features in this that I have not seen before that look important. So I'm going to run it against a training instance, a small subset of these patients, and see how important that feature is. And if it appears to stay important in that small training instance, we're then going to take it to the big population and see how accurate it is. And so think of it almost as research, but instead of needing 100 analysts to do the work, the computer can do the work of 100 analysts in a few seconds. So it literally is just speeding up the time to knowledge. And that really is the definition of machine learning. So we already have 4.5 million patients. We already understand how to predict mortality predictions in 10 days, 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, and 12 months. We already understand when a person qualifies for all the things that would make them hospice appropriate. We also understand how to predict palliative. We also understand how to predict home health and how to transition from home health to palliative and hospice. And all of those things keep getting better. The bigger the tool, the more time it has with the data, the bigger the data population, all of those things really make it smarter. And we're lucky to have started 5 years ago on this journey and have been working specifically on these problems for that long.
Well, I wanted to go back and start a little bit earlier in this process of patient care and talk about another issue that I've been seeing for quite a long time, which is the fact that we don't have good information sharing between the entities that are providing healthcare. And even though we most like clinics and hospitals and facilities now are using electronic health records, I still don't see good communication of information. And it seems like that's a huge issue we have to overcome. We have to be able to share that information in order to reach this point where we're getting good data. So do you have ideas for that, how to fix that problem?
Yeah, so we think about that as interoperability. Interoperability has been a buzzword in healthcare for about 15 years. But honestly, for the most part, where we are today is very little advanced from where we were when we created the concepts in the vernacular 15 years ago. The fact that these systems can talk to each other doesn't mean that they've made it efficient for clinicians like you in the roles you've played in the past to make use of the data that could come across that wire. So what we think about is being able to use the interoperability, this idea of systems talking to each other, mostly to augment point of care decisions. So, you know, if you trust big organizations that do research in healthcare like Gartner says that about 80% of the time clinicians make decisions without having but a portion of what could be known about a patient at their fingertips. So that means most every decision, even when it's a fairly simple case, we're missing opportunities to do a better job of understanding and then, you know, prescribing or understanding and referring. So we think the way to do this is through the build out of a third platform for healthcare. And I'll describe the first two so it makes sense for everybody. The first platform was built, 40 years ago, almost 50 years ago now, where it was really just a mechanism to manage the revenue side of healthcare. Like, how do you get reimbursed for the services you're providing? So all of the claims and benefits, tooling, all the payer, all the clearinghouse, all of those things have been built in the first platform. The second platform was the electronic health record or electronic medical record. This was how a clinician typically documents like SOAP notes, subjective assessment plan, like the encounter itself is usually inside of the electronic medical record. And then the third platform, which is being developed by lots of people, it takes data out of the first two platforms. It gives data back to those first two platforms, but it really isn't built just for the claims and benefits side of healthcare or just the electronic medical record. It does things like case management, like transitioning between different locations of care, or if you're a patient, between different levels of need, like chronic to acute to end of life. It really is going to be this connective tissue. And we're part of the build out for it, but a whole host of other organizations are. And when this third platform, I always think of like Amazon as a good reference. Like Amazon started selling books, and now they have Alexa in almost every home. They are in almost every technology software company. Amazon Web Services is being used. Like they've become sort of everything to everyone. And the third platform of healthcare is going to literally deconstruct these silos and literally provide technology almost like Alexa does to your house or Siri does if you're an Apple user, where it just makes it so simple for you to access your own health records, for you to give those to the next clinician, for you to work together seamlessly, for you to be at home and be served over telemedicine. Like that is the future of healthcare. And the challenges that are the only obstacles left, honestly, have mostly been removed by COVID. If you think about what COVID did for telemedicine or what it did for remote patient monitoring or what it did for these waivers under the emergency state of emergency acts, that literally has created finally for us in the United States this notion of being consumers. And that consumer push in healthcare is going to create a lot of these connections that have been so hard to make over the past 15 years.
So COVID really sped up the tipping point, it seems like, for us reaching this point of acceptance where people are much more open to the idea and actually see potential in the idea of telemedicine and how we could have a new future in how healthcare is provided.
And I think CMS was a little bit surprised by how fast the aged adult population actually took on and participated in that technology of telemedicine. When you couldn't get into a skilled facility where you were literally in lockdown, a whole host of organizations immediately turned on features that the consumers who are Medicare age immediately took advantage of. I mean, we as a family didn't go to any place, retail, restaurant, anywhere. We certainly weren't going to go to a place where COVID exposure was going to be the most high risk, like primary care or other facilities in our healthcare environment. So we, like everyone else, was doing any of our healthcare needs literally remotely and virtually. I think that is a huge incentive for that to continue as a path forward for fixing these issues I mentioned about interoperability and connectedness.
And I think, of course, there's always a fear of something new and a fear of change. But when you get pushed to make a change, even when you're resistant to it or you're fearful of it, you discover that there's something positive and great and new within that change, like not having to sit and wait for an hour in a cold waiting room with, last year's magazines. I mean, you start to find new benefits in what is new. And I think you're right. The adoption of telehealth proceeded so much more quickly than any of us would have discovered or would have imagined. But I did want to say, I know for people out there who still are thinking, oh, no, we don't need all this technology, sounds frightening in healthcare. I think when you talk about deconstructing silos, everyone needs to be aware of how harmful silos are in medicine when various entities cannot communicate and cannot work together. That is harmful to patients and to the care they receive. So would you reiterate that? Do you agree with that?
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, maybe as a way to even take it one step further is the future of healthcare will be much more connected. And what I mean by that is, today, reimbursement, how providers, clinicians get paid for their services is firewalled between different lines of care. So if I was a hospital-anchored integrated delivery network that had primary care and skilled nursing and palliative and hospice, it's very difficult for almost little populations or little pools of behaviors that naturally take shape. The human condition is that we recognize what's old and familiar and comfortable, like the old comfortable shoe, right? It's, oh, we want to put that on, that feels comfortable, I'm used to it. But what that does is it creates real static and difficulty for patients to flow evenly, naturally through from one level of care and one need to another level of care for another need to another level of care for a third need. And if you want to prove that to yourself, if you've watched your family members go through a stillness where the only person that knows everything is the spouse or the daughter, that's proof of how we are not incented today to break those silos down. So it may sound familiar and comfortable to go to your oncologist and familiar and comfortable to go to your cardiologist. And you can say to your head and say to yourself, well, he knows me or she knows me. The fact is they don't. The fact is what your cardiologist knows about you doesn't make its way to your oncologist, doesn't make its way to your neurologist, doesn't make its way to your primary care, doesn't make its way to the emergency triage staff, doesn't make its way to the hospital staff. And you, as a byproduct of that, fractured system, get far less desirable outcomes clinically. And we spend far more on those bad outcomes than most every other nation. So in the future, what literally will happen is almost think of it this way. If you were to take a car that was having an issue to any part of the United States or the world for that matter, they would literally run a test against the computer system and say, well, what are the diagnostics of this car? What does it need? And then they would just resolve that. In this case, by fragmenting down to these specialties, which is phenomenal for invasive procedures. I'm never going to say that we don't do great work when there's a significant issue of fixing that issue. I'm saying, though, that the problem is that when it's a significant issue across 17 different conditions, we don't have a generalist that can literally look at the CPU of that person and say, I have all the facts. And this is the best path forward based upon all the frailty, all the functional decline, all of these disease burdens. No one does that. We look at them by disease state. We're a person first. We're not our diagnoses. We're a person first. We're not our frailty. We're a person first. We're not these issues. And when medicine starts paying for that to be the outcome, which is coming, then all of these silos that exist today are going to be softened, and we're going to have a generalist perspective that does case management or navigation or transition services, whatever we want to call it. And they're going to get paid to actually deliver outcomes that improve, because it'll be easy to improve outcomes when the silos are softened. And today we have all these perverse incentives that sort of keep them in place, and tomorrow those will all be removed.
That's just so true what you're describing. And again, I can say as a hospice doctor, there were times when patients would tell us that coming on hospice was the first time anyone had ever asked them about all of the medications that have been prescribed for them. You know, that all of the specialists they had seen had never really made a detailed list of the treatments and medications the patient had received for other things that were going on in their lives. And it wasn't until hospice that we put that list together and started looking at medication interactions and talking about how, you know, what treatments are the most important, what are making the biggest difference in terms of symptom management. And so that was always shocking to me, as you described this, that there truly are silos out there, that even doctors who are giving their very best care for their specialty don't really know what else is happening in that patient's treatment. So it's going to be powerful to be able to break those silos down and have all the information there for every patient when it's most needed.
Yeah, and I think luckily for all of us, the federal government, that's the largest payer in the United States, is CMS, right, with Medicare. They recognize exactly that problem too. And so they have built a huge opportunity for us collectively to take advantage of, which is to allow access to all data about all Medicare patients to anyone who is caring for those patients. So across all of those silos we just described, Medicare has all of the institutional detail. So what procedures were done, what diagnoses exist, what medications were administered across institutional settings, across primary care settings, across specialty settings, literally it all, because they're paying for it all. And that gets given to every clinician who has the responsibility to treat those patients. Now, what has to happen and what we're doing is that needs to be human readable. It needs to be informing a decision at the point of care. It needs to be seamless to their workflow. Like, that's what we do as a business, but we're one of many that are literally taking the data that's rarely ever investigated and promoting it into that world where, like, as you mentioned, when you're working as a hospice intake clinician and you're doing the med reconciliation, great. Here is every bit of meds that they've had an order for by fill date. And here's the NDC codes. So you literally can know when you're interviewing that patient, not only to ask the question, but to ask it from an objective perspective. I see you fill these meds lately. Are these still all being actively taken? That's a much easier way to do it than, you know, tell me all the meds you're on. That's a really tough thing for many patients, especially as they're entering hospice, to even know, because you're relying on the spouse or the sister or the daughter.
Yeah, and much easier than being handed a bag full of pill bottles and, right, and going through by hand and listing all of them one by one. So when we go back to the machine learning, I just wanted to know where are we in the process of implementing that? Is it still being studied? Is it this still just a research project, or is it being actually implemented in real practice right now?
To my knowledge, it's just us and Stanford so far that have deployed. Stanford, I think today, according to what they've published, send a list of patients that need attention to the attending associated with those persons inside of their facility. We do it a bit differently. We sort of talk about this particular item as if it was you know, as black and white as malignancy or you know, benign pathology result. It's not quite that black and white. We sort of need to think of them almost like we're tracking a person through a progression. And when you do that, you want to triangulate about where the next likely point on the trend is going to head towards. So the way we triangulate ourselves that is we create a number of markers that include frailty, functional status via PPS measures, these prognosis predictions, opportunity for the next referral, that's a prediction, I'm sorry, next inpatient admission, those are all predictions. And then from that data, we look at what a hospice typically looks like. So you were a previous medical director. Most hospices rely on their medical director to make these decisions and sign off on the certificate of terminal illness. But they typically rely on functional status by PPS. They typically rely on if things run the normal course, as personal pass in the next 6 months. And they typically rely on like utilization in the emergency room or hospital. So we triangulate those plus all these other markers and build it as a literal dashboard, like literally a dashboard that the clinicians can look at. And then they would stack rank them by mortality prediction or stack rank them by level of utilization or stack rank them by PPS or any other number of things they want to do. And that creates for them the ability to make referrals or to catch referrals or to be a part of the referral triage team. And all of those are deployed today across all 50 states, literally working in a connected community. Literally aligning with our resources that send us the referrals typically, literally sitting within their teams, looking at patients that have specific markers, literally helping them make these decisions together, literally having conversations with the patient and their family, and then literally getting them into that level of care that's appropriate for them. So we're ahead of everybody when it comes to sort of operationalizing this, but we think there'll be fast follows, and certainly Stanford is a fast follower.
Well, I know that the goals for this technological movement are, for one, to improve the care that patients receive, to make sure they're getting the appropriate care, and that's mentioned in your bio, at the right time in the right place. Also, there's a financial goal because we know we have one of the most expensive healthcare systems in the world, the most expensive, and yet we're nowhere near the top in terms of the quality of care that we offer. And that needs to change. We want to be able to give our patients the best care, but we don't want to be wasting money in the process of doing it. So let's review a little bit about how, when we do manage patients better who have serious illness, how it ends up costing less and making us more efficient in terms of how we spend the healthcare dollars we have available.
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, one of the facts I'll sort of use as a part of the answer is, you know, the last 30 days of life in the United States costs on average $32,000. Hospice as a benefit is roughly a $5,000 service for that last 30 days. So it doesn't take an abacus or a calculator to figure out we could save $27,000 per death in the United States if we just deployed hospice for 30 days. Now, the benefit's 6 months, and we can get into how many savings events could happen in the six-month journey, but just getting that part right to start would be huge. The reason this matters, because I think people sometimes say, why would we talk about dollars when we're talking about healthcare? That really is almost, a paradox. The care and the dollars shouldn't go together. Nobody looks for the cheapest heart surgeon. I get it, but the problem that you mentioned about the United States spending so much is that with baby boomers aging into the benefit of Medicare at a clip of about 10,000 persons per day, every day, and they'll do that for the next 15 years. Like, the problem we have today is going to literally be a doomsday event for us if we don't figure out how to do it better for this size of the population that's going to be in Medicare. And it'll impact the price of everything. And I'm not, this isn't a scare tactic. This is just facts. The previous administration under President Trump, they were projecting Part A, which pays for all of our institutional spend to sort of run out of funds and be upside down in 2026. That was pre-COVID, those predictions. The Obama administration before that was sort of like 2028, again, pre-COVID. So if you look at what COVID did to the Part A and how much was actually spent and lost under delivering that care. I mean, we literally on the precipice of running out of funding sources for the care we're delivering. So I know we keep finding ways to improve the or increase the deficit. I know we keep doing all these stopgap measures, but eventually that can't continue. And if we're spending as much as we are on healthcare and aren't getting good quality outcomes, this is the place to fix the problem. And they're going to do it with hatchets and not scalpels. They're going to literally say, fine, I know how to fix it. Hospice is now 50%, you know, of what it was last yesterday. And literally every hospice in the history of hospice is going to fall apart. But if we don't get in front of it and ourselves provide solutions to help each other do this well, then they're going to be left with only hatchets as the tool to sort of fix the problem. And we want them to be using scalpels and making good cuts to the things that are heavy and clumsy and inefficient and these silos that need to be broken down versus them saying, okay, we're literally running in a position where we're not going to be able to fund Medicare. That's going to happen if we don't change our behaviors. And the way we should hope to change it is by getting involved and actually having these discussions. So go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and also that patients, many, many patients, I think the majority of patients who are the recipients of that expensive healthcare at the very end of life don't want that care. That's not even how they wanted to be cared for if you had done a survey and talked to them about it. They're getting care they don't really want, and they're missing out on the type of care that would have benefited them much more. So it's not just we're talking about, oh, we're going to withhold care from patients. We want to give patients, as you said, the care that they actually want, which happens to be less expensive, instead of wasting money on care that interferes with their quality of life and their time with their families at the very end of life. So yeah, it's a win-win on both of those questions.
I think the only loser in this whole scenario that you know, if there is one, are the persons who are potentially being bad actors anyway. And I'm not calling out any individual specialty or subspecialty or any individual clinician or role or any of those things. But if your job and the way that you are paid is for volume, then you're incented to do more. If your job is to be paid by outcome, then you're incented to do well. And I think those two differences matter, because I will tell you, you know, nobody wants to apply, you know, a hip replacement or even more oncology services to a person in the last 6 weeks of life. They're not going to recover. So those are going to make whatever time they have left, to your point, less quality life. And no one wants to do that. So given the opportunity to do what's right or what's paid for is a conundrum. That's why I talk about perverse incentives. Like there are literally incentives in today's healthcare in the United States that perversely incentivize the 80% of persons that want to die at home having their death 65% of the time in the hospital. Like, that's just fact. So we should fix that fact. That's a scalpel, right? That's fix that incentive in a way goes so much spend. Instead of saying, oh, let's just give everybody a haircut and you have to work more for less. That's a hatchet. And I think we gotta be smart about how we do these things as a society. And then honestly, how as a provider care team, we feel comfortable with these changes culminating in some single solution, not single payer, but single solution for all services. Like that's the way that it'll eventually look like if it's going to keep pace with, you know, the leaders of the pack that spend less and get better quality.
And Jeremy, can you tell us about the results you found, the outcomes from the studies you've been doing using machine learning and artificial intelligence for prognosis?
So maybe I'll give you some current events. We were just at MGMA, which is the Medical Group Management Association. So these are traditionally, clinics that offer specialty care, oncology, cardiology, you know, pulmonology, or primary care type services. And one of our customers that's been with us since late 2017, something like that, they spoke on our behalf and spoke to their colleagues about what it is to build quality into your practice. And obviously we're using all of our tooling there. We're partnered in a number of ways with some partners that do palliative and home delivery of hospice and community services for these patients that are the sickest in that population. And I think the most compelling part of what we were able to listen to this customer talk about on our behalf, but at this big conference, was that it's rare that people share the good news of running the business of healthcare with each other. And so for her to stand up and describe what they built from scratch, what the technology, the people, the process, what they do in their day-to-day lives, and then what it created for them as incremental revenue as a practice, just doing good medicine, was a very, very rare expression of maybe vulnerability or being the most human you can be. Because often we talk in buzzwords and we sort of stick to a storyline that we're comfortable with. And this was very much her saying, we should help each other get here. Because getting here means our patients get better outcomes, our families that we're serving feel more confident in decision-making. There's not the guilt of the things that happen when deaths occur in a hospital where you may have to have an impactful decision around pulling the plug for a family member, all those things that are making it difficult. And on top of it all, they as a practice in their community are seeing increased revenues. I think that's the most compelling sort of current event that just happened a few weeks ago, last month in October. This is going to be later in the year, but a few weeks back, that was the most compelling because it allowed for there to be a real exchange of information that literally allows everybody to see that when you do this, it changes not only the satisfaction level of your patients and their families, but it also changes your ability to sort of fund yourself for other innovations that will, again, consistently put you ahead of your competition in your market, and more importantly, ahead of these quality measures that matter to you as a provider of care.
And I want to just emphasize for anyone listening who, you know, feels nervous about this idea of increasing technology around hospice care, that, you know, we're talking about big data and numbers, and it sounds very impersonal, but the fact is hospice care and palliative care are both totally patient-centered in terms of the actual delivery of care, and that will never change. The staffs who deliver the care to patients will still look at every unique individual patient and their families and offer them what they need. That is not going to change, no matter what the technology is. Perhaps the staff will be able to interact earlier in the disease process with a patient and family. And maybe the services they offer to the patient will be better targeted to the patient's needs because of technology. But I just want to make sure that people don't feel alarmed in our conversation when we go take the big view and look at data and talk about numbers of people, that nothing about the actual day-to-day person-centered care will change in a harmful way. If anything, it will get better. And maybe you can reassure us more about that factor.
Yeah, I mean, I think about the hospice survey question around, do you wish you had heard of or gotten involved with hospice sooner? And almost 100% of respondents will say yes, because they were so positively impacted by hospice, as just one example. What we're doing literally is just creating these opportunities to occur more naturally sooner, so that, again, you can experience what is such a great part of healthcare, which is this, you know, this transition from being a part of a family here to being a part of a transition where your family who is left behind after your death is also cared for. And we believe that journey, eventually extends beyond what the current 6-month benefit for hospice is. We think it elongates to 12 or even 18 months. Because I think we're going to find, this is what I keep talking about, sort of this idea of this sort of universal service opening up itself to consumerism, right? Telemedicine and remote patient monitoring will allow us to take patients earlier into a journey who are so severely impacted that their family members are starting to feel burnout, and giving them the kinds of care that's appropriate, and then making sure that, to your point, it's person-centric, that it's very much interdisciplinary. So you have social worker support, chaplaincy for spiritual needs, nursing and physician. So we think exactly like you, that our tooling really is just giving more persons the opportunity to get the right kind of care.
Yes, exactly. And I wanted to ask about Acclivity Health Solutions, if you are doing anything or what you're doing to help educate the public about these ideas and also educating medical providers.
So we're at a number, we didn't travel honestly at all for probably almost 18 months. And we did, I think, 5 or 6 weeks back to back to back. National Association of ACOs, we were at that conference. MGMA management, of medical groups, we were at that conference. We were at Elevate in Chicago, which was a hospice news conference. We were, I'm forgetting a handful of the others that we were at, but we do that specifically in support of sort of macro market messaging, like the big picture. But then individually, down to the associations inside of the states for hospice, for palliative, national associations like NHPCO and MPHI, American Academy of Home Care Medicine. Like, so literally we're training up today's clinical teams. We're training up the organizations across all 50 states. We have great partners that are doing this work with us, big payers, their services arms like Optum. Again, doing the best we can to make sure we can really drive an impact so these patients and their families can have better outcomes. And I liken it to like our experience. We have three children, and the perinatal experience where birth and delivery, labor, all of those things for all three kids was just world class. And I think we can do exactly that for the end of life and have really good bookmarks on a person's life. And I think, if I'm honest, that's our mission. And I think what we're seeing now is the data is coming to be far more open by CMS. The rhetoric of these rationing of healthcare kinds of things from like 2008 when the Affordable Care Act was passed, that's all behind us because there's too big a problem to talk about those ideas anymore because we literally are running out of funding from Medicare. So like this perfect storm is setting up to push us forward and to actually deliver something impactful for all of us that are going to face the inevitable at some point, which is the end of our lives, and to have it done, be done as well as we see the first parts of our life done in healthcare. That's our mission.
That's really well stated. And I just want to emphasize for the listening audience that this future is not to be feared. This is actually what we need. It's going to solve a lot of the problems that have already been plaguing us for a long time. And Jeremy, before we started recording, you talked about an analogy with just real estate. I really liked that because it's something, we recently bought a new condo. And so I'm very familiar with what you're talking about, why moving forward into the future and using technology is not a bad thing. It helps all of us. So maybe you could just describe that again for the audience.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty scary to hear about something that seems too like science fiction or unfamiliar. And the thing we were talking about before we got started was, well, think about how you used to buy a house like 20 years ago. You would have these MLS books that would come out, and on Wednesday it would be all the new sales, and they would have this really small, like 3-inch by 2-inch front picture of the house, and then it would describe like the square footage, the number of rooms, did it have a central air conditioning? Like, it was very basics, and that was it. You could then get in a car with a realtor, maybe drive to 3 or 4 of them. That was how you bought a house. And then on like Fridays, the comps would come out so you could figure out how much should you pay for it. Like, that was the state of the science, 20 years ago. Now think about the, Zillows and the realtor.coms of the world that literally have made that tribal knowledge held by a vital few realtors in your market available to everyone. And nobody would buy a house through that kind of book approach where you look at a little single picture. Today they're doing videos and you can do walkthroughs and you literally can decide how much it should cost looking at their estimates. Like, it is game changing, and nobody lost. The realtors still make their commission. Home buyers are happier. That's what's going to happen in healthcare. And we're just leading the charge towards this newer version of better. And I think that is a great one to sort of use as an example.
Yeah, just a comfortable analogy for everyone to say, oh, that
that sounds okay. That's all right. That's been a really good change. And I'm happy about that in my life. So I really appreciate that you've come to just share all of this amazing technology that you're working on through Acclivity. And do you have any information that listeners could sign up for on your website, like to get newsletters or get more information?
Sure. Yeah, please have them come to Acclivity, acclivityhealth.com. We have a resources page. We'll have, you know, request a demo, calls to action that they can follow up on there. Pretty much everything. And then obviously they can find us on social media, wherever they like to get any of their information from, we're there.
And I noticed on your website, you have lots and lots of partners who would be familiar to people who are in this audience, like the Conversation Project. And I don't know if you could list a few of your other partners. So, so you're not just operating out there in the dark on your own. You have lots and lots of support from other organizations that really care about the end of life.
Yeah, this is our mission. We do believe we're going to have an impact. And so certainly NHPCO, NPHI, AAHPM, these are all acronyms I'm throwing out. These are national associations whose sole focus is to help organizations better care for patients that are facing advanced illness, often life-limiting and even end-of-life care. Conversation Project, as you mentioned, working on PULSE and MULSE, which are physician orders for life-sustaining treatment, like all of those organizations that are in this space, we are partnered with. Or literally work on behalf through our interoperability framework to make sure that their impact on healthcare is also heightened.
Well, this is all such exciting news. And I just want to thank you, Jeremy, for really talking about it at a level that I could understand and grasp, and hopefully our listeners as well. And I feel optimistic after hearing what you're doing and what you're working on. And so I'm grateful for all the work of Acclivity Health Solutions. And I thank you too for taking time with me today.
Oh, Dr. Wyatt, I appreciate the opportunity. I know how important the work is you're doing, and thanks for letting us be a part of it.
Sure. And I hope we've put the minds at rest of people listening in today. And so
yeah, same here.
Maybe we can follow up down the road and see how things are going.
That would be great. I look forward to it.
All right. Take care.
You as well.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jeremy. I was very excited to learn from him that this new machine learning technology is going to increase the number of patients who get referred in a timely manner for palliative care and hospice care. And we talked about all the reasons why that's likely to happen and how this technology is really offering support to referring physicians who may feel uncertain or reluctant about when to refer and who to refer. So I feel optimistic that we're headed in the right direction and we're going to help more people receive the kind of care they want at the end of life, as I expressed during the interview. And as much as we all want the dying process to be natural and organic in a sense for the patients and the people we love and care for, I don't feel that technology is going to interfere with that. Our task will be to continue to provide the quality of care that supports the dignity and worth of every patient that we have been providing all along. So go to the Acclivity Health website if you're interested in learning more about this kind of technology, and let other people know what you've been learning about here. If you like this content, please share it with other people who might also benefit from listening in. And also be sure to subscribe or follow the podcast wherever you happen to be listening, whatever platform you happen to use, and leave a rating and review if you're so inclined, because that improves the ranking of this podcast so more people can find it who are searching for this kind of information. So until next week, remember, we're here for love. So face your fear. Be ready for whatever life brings you next, and love each and every moment of your precious and fleeting life. Bye-bye.